What I want to do today is to continue what we have been doing with Richard Rohr's book, and that is to do a theology of experience of Trinity. And so the first thing I've named the workshop. A theology of Trinity, just one theology of Trinity, for a time being. Not for the time being, for a time being. And the only way you could have a theology for a time being, as opposed to an angel, is if you have it body-based. Now, I think it was 1975, a year after I married Dawn, that he and I met Ed and Pete, as they're fondly known, Ed McMahon and Pete Campbell, who teach focusing. And we were introduced to this body-based way of being with God, or with being in the world. Fortunately, Don and I were asked to assist them when they did the workshops by leading small groups, because you can't really do it over a weekend without having someone assist you and lead you. That's impossible here today. So I'm going to give you some references online. The name, in case I forget later, is Anne Weiser. Especially, she started to work with Jenlyn in 1972. Eugene Jenlyn is the one who put out this little book on focusing, and was immensely generous in his way of distributing this experience. He himself was a student of Carl Rogers, and as Carl Rogers said, that what he found changed in his patients' lives was a quality of him in which he was saying, "For me, honey, you don't have to change." That is, to be with people without any program for them. To be with them, allowing their own experience to reflect back what needs to move. And he would hold the container. Well, what Jenlyn found is that the thing that added more than anything else was if there could also be a body felt sense, which we often, those of us who work in this, just shorten to the felt sense. Okay, so, but it's a bodily felt sense. So I was going to open with an exercise. However, I was thrilled that Judith wanted to all open with an exercise which also could be very much bodily felt. I'd like you to just think of it now, and if you are like me, you might have forgotten it already, because it's really hard to hold on to nouns as we get older. But she asked if God were to ask you to say it again, Sam.
If God were to speak to you and offer you a single sentence.
Yes.
If God were to speak to you and offer you a single sentence, one that you most need to hear in your life right now, what might God say to you?
What might God say to you? What did God say to you back about 5 or 10 minutes ago? And listening, but noting this time in your body, if there was any quickening, and notice the quality of that. Notice the quality. Can I just have a sense if the quality is, I want to get some sense of whether it was on the positive side, neutral, or it was hurtful or shocking. Positive side. Okay. God's sweet today. Neutral? Okay. Alarming in some way. Okay, it might be, but I will go with, I had a plan to open with asking you that if on your way here, you had a moment of gratitude. So this is going to fill really in, because it's not hard to feel gratitude if God has spoken to us and we have a sense of positive sense, a sense of joy or pleasure or honor or encouragement. So see if you can allow your body to hold some of that positive sense from what you heard. See if you can allow yourself to be even more heartfelt in the gratitude. And now proceeding on with this process we'll explore today, notice if there is, or has been already, a word or an image that expresses, that came out of that. And it doesn't have to be an answer. It can be anything. It is what it is. So allow yourself to notice if that, you know, for instance, one could be, I could feel grateful. I feel so heartfelt, or I feel so privileged, or I feel eager to go back to that. Anything. I want to give you an idea of the scope of the image or the word. And then, and this is an important part of the process, is that you take these sort of two things that are here. One is the felt expression or the felt sense of gratitude, and then the movement to an expression of that in either word or image. You take those two and you resonate them with one another. You rumble them up. You let them have intercourse, my God. Let them impact each other and see if there emerges a third. And if so, usually there is a different body felt sense. That's how we know the two have rumbled together, resonated. That there is a different body sense. The different body sense might be along the same line. It could be deeper gratitude, deeper pleasure. But don't be surprised if it actually can shoot into something. Oh my God, and I was so ungrateful. Or, oh my God, you know, it can go in either direction. So don't put a prejudice on it. Don't prejudge it. But notice, and this is for our teaching here, notice if there's a difference in your body. The felt sense has shifted in any direction. And I'm going to ask you, you know, if you could give me a show of hands, how many had that shift? Okay. All right. About a third of you. And that's usually very good for this kind of artificial way of doing focusing that's happening. Hopefully, all of you will have this experience sometime today, or you might go back to a time when you felt that that shift in the focusing experience. But I'm wanting to do two things today, and one is to use focusing, not to really teach it, because it takes much more time than we have, but I want to do Trinity with you. And so what I experience in my own self is that the felt sense is very much in the beginning. In the beginning was God. In the beginning. Okay. And then if you stay with that felt sense of any kind, one down and dirty, anything, in the right way, and the right way means allowing it, like Carl Rogers did when he gave the message, honey, for me you don't have to change. I want to just hear what you have to say. Okay? So it's non-judging, non-criticizing, it's allowing. So if you're with the felt sense in that way, did it express itself further? Did it open up and start to tell you a story? Did it express itself? Now, if this is the felt sense and we think of this as God, God seemed not to want to stay huddled up as a dot. God expressed herself in an expression which we call, in our written theology, the Word. Most likely, in an earlier time, we would have had an image, because before the alphabet, and there was a lot of time before the alphabet, a lot of time for humans to be, the expression of being, so to speak, hit by God is an expression in an image or a word. And it's not enough to keep them separate, and it seemed like it wasn't enough in our theology of God to imagine only a God the Father, to be very traditional, and a God the Son. But in the Council of Nicaea, much to the chagrin and embarrassment and annoyance of the Eastern churches, there is a phrase in Latin that says, not only did this bring about this, but this brought about it. The theological discussion is called filioque. And those of you who know Latin, que at the end always means and. Filio, of course, is son. But it's an and that is so close that you're not going to use the word et. You're not going to use deus et filio, filius. You're going to use filioque. That the two of them together, and so I'm matching here the expression of resonating with that to produce a shift that is something new. A baby, in some cases, but in cases of focusing, it moves the journey along. It moves the knowing, the felt knowing along. Now, it's not over there, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this, but what I would like to sort of do, I have another one of these triangles here. I want to imagine that there is a spiral of such trinities that moves along in time. And that same way as in focusing, you don't have just one triangle and you're through. You sometimes have to have a dozen of these repetitions and of felt shifts. And sometimes the felt shifts go down deeper into darkness before they come up into what feels like, gosh, I'd like to hang out here. And sometimes you get the, I want to hang out here in one fell swoop. When I went to Chicago one of the times and did work with Jen Lynn, and the people he had accumulated around him to give us individual time, we worked for 2 hours on a feeling I had of toxic shame. And at some point, and we took even a break, but we were silent. At some point, I had a complete shift that I think has lasted all my life. Thank goodness I'm not shameless, because it would be totally horrible to be shameless, because we do things that it's good to be ashamed of. But toxic shame is a shame for being alive, a shame for being you. And none of us need to live with that. And if we find that we have some of that, we could start to pray that we may be relieved through grace, through a process like this. Hopefully there'd be somebody who would go on the journey with you so that you don't have that toxic frame, that toxic, you know, that is a sense of shame for being alive. As a child, we pick up stuff, and it came back to, it was an incident when I was 5 years old, which I won't go into, but that's not uncommon. So, just to recap so far, in the beginning was the felt sense. Let's compare it to God the Father. It stayed with, in the right way, a word or an image will come. And we can think of this as the only Son of the Father, only for that moment. And then those two staying together in resonance produces love, the resonance or the shift to the third. So you could say, or I can say, this is how I do Trinity. This is how I do Trinity. In the book, Richard Rohr's book, somewhere, I hope I still have it. Wouldn't that be funny? Yeah. No, I want my copy of it. Here it is. The reason I want my copy of it is I have a hardbound, and look at that. Isn't that nice? It's in the back, too. It's nice. And do you recognize it, those of you who have been here from day one? It's the icon that Anne had a lovely copy of, and Anne... yes, I have a copy of that too, thank you, somewhere in here, it might fall out. As Anne, when Anne presented, some of what Anne presented was the notion of our participation in the picture in so many different ways. The title of the book, The Dance. A dance is something we participate in. So the participation is really the theme of Rohr's book. That is, the experience of Trinity through joining an icon, through a dance, through Reverend Cindy, who looked the other way, like if she was going to find someone else. Reverend Cindy did in terms of the family. That's where she found Trinity at one point. But she also found it in the dance. And she suggested we really do a participatory dance. And we all did the hokey pokey. And I would say that most likely some of what I'm talking about in this process of focusing was experienced there in any one of those incidences, because if you really participated in it, say the dancing, you felt a shift, because when we get up and we move our bodies and we put our bodies in there, our bodies do something if they're really there and not someone else, a sense of well-being. So now what I want to do is to go to the, I want to do this again and again and again, because basically you don't get it in one time. But I'm going to each time bring in more and more of the book. So the section I had to look at was beginning with Richard of St. Victor. I'm afraid Richard Rohr read the account of him a little too fast, because he puts him in Paris. He was in Paris as a visitor. Do you know where he was from? He was from Scotland. And he was part of this Celtic church in Scotland. And with in this group, over and over again, gotten an idea of both Celtic spirituality and Christian Celtic spirituality. And one of the things we know about it is that it involved nature and it involved body. The Irish... My good mother was born in Ireland and went to the West Indies, and that's how come I was born down in the West Indies. They have dance in their bodies. They have dance in their spirituality, and we've been privileged to have here people who know Iona and know places where all are welcome and... including our bodies. So he was very interesting in that he was the first one, it would appear, to put down in writing anything about the experience of God. He's about the 12th century. Let's see if it's earlier. You know, 12th century. He died in 1173. And he was there just about a century before Thomas Aquinas. And we could put Thomas Aquinas in a slot if we only think of him as the Summa Theologica writer. And when they did that writing, it was very cerebral, very much philosophical, had a chord to that, and all of those pipes were pulled out to have that. But Thomas Aquinas was also an alchemist. Which at that time, the alchemist experience was basically a mystical experience. And we could say it most likely took you through the same emotional experience as I am presenting today for focusing, that you were embodied. And Thomas Aquinas is supposed to have said, after he finished the Summa Theologica, this is all like rubbish. You know, because he had experienced the divine directly. But luckily for us, he didn't tear it all up, because it also is something for us to work up against if we so need. But I don't think anybody in this room really needs to go back to the Summa Theologica. But it was actually an enlightened version of things. by this man. So let's see where I am. I felt a little nervous, in spite of all of what I've said so far, a little nervous about talking about Trinity from the point of view of experience, you know, to write a theology for a time being. So I've sought out two authorities besides Richard Rohr, authorities that are actually known in this town. But I think it goes back to an experience I had maybe 20 years ago when I was teaching focusing. Felicia Carroll, some of you know her, and I taught focusing weekend at La Casa de Maria for about maybe 15 years. We had three of them a year, and we had other people who helped us be in small groups. And in the course of this, I did this little bit that I have now that I think my experience of Trinity, in fact, I have to go back one more thing, and that is I got this when, you know, those of you here who are Catholics and those of you who are friends of Catholics know most likely that we went through a whole sorting out of our saints, and we found out that St. Christopher, who saved us, you know, in driving, was no longer a saint because he most likely didn't exist. And the same with Philomena. And I was an Ursuline nun who was named in honor of Ursula and her 10,000 virgins. They said there most likely was never 10,000 virgins in her town. At any rate, she was 4th century, you see, really. But there, whether there is that or not, we certainly know that there is in the canopy protection for us when we drive. And how we want to access it, through somebody called Christopher, or we want to access it another way, a way that my Native Americans do, it doesn't matter. It's that we access that we are protected if we call on the protection. The same with, I've lost my train of thought. I'll say, part of the reason I know I was so emotional in the beginning is I can hardly remember a sentence from 1 minute to the next. Unless I'm on a spiel. And so I have never been this nervous. And I certainly wasn't going to read to you. Let me get back to. I know. When somebody said, what would you do if someone told you? You know, the Trinity was put together around the 3rd or 4th century, you know, when a lot of stuff was done. What if there's no Trinity? You know, the Vatican has spoken, there's no more Trinity. How do you feel about it? And I remember feeling very sure, focusing is my Trinity. That experience had already been articulated in my mind, and that it didn't have to be blessed to be something that's there. And that one of the wonderful things in this book is to see how many threenesses there are. You know, when the wonderful preacher, Hall, Reverend Hall, last week, said that he hadn't been able to do uncover too much of the threeness by Gersteef that Bougeot worked on. There are all many threenesses, and I'm going to unfold some of them for you or for us today. But threeness is, and certainly it's not a big jump to call it Trinity, That's another way of talking about threeness. And so we can each have our own special Trinity that moves us. And Harriet, Harriet and I walk. When you told me yesterday about the cherubim, in that story, does it have, maybe I could have you come up real quick and give me a break. Is that not on? No. Look at Harriet. She's walking without her walker.
No, I'm okay. I was telling Dawn yesterday as we were walking that one of the things that really, really struck me from the book, the image that Richard Rohr used was about the Ark of the Covenant and how it traveled along with the people and beside it were the two cherubim. I don't know if this struck you, but it really struck me and how he took that into another direction and said that we are the Ark of the Covenant. We carry the Word of God with
and
us.
And I think in Scripture it's possible that the cherubim sang Sanctus, 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 or we translated it that way. If so, isn't that a lovely coincidence that they were treated with a certain degree of threeness?
Yeah. And how we each should have, and this was a thing for me, we each should have cherubim beside us that I took it to mean boundaries that don't let the dark end into our lives. Now, that's something I kind of read into it. Angels aren't a part of my spirituality so much, so it really added another dimension for me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I told her, well, I have two angels, and I named them some time back, Ying and Yang. And they have appeared in a very sensate way when I have been in some danger. And I hope, or I invite you to invite your angels. They do not have to be visible, though sometimes they do that. They let themselves take on flesh for you to have a felt experience of them. Tom.
I have a musical perspective on what you're describing,
right,
which comes from the phenomenon that I'm familiar with a lot, which is the phenomenon of a triad.
Mm-hmm.
A triad meaning the essential elements of a chord. And there's a legend among musicians, which is that Saint Cecilia,
mm-hmm,
our patroness, supposedly, again, she was fortunately unearthed in the 16th century or so, and someone quickly took a snapshot. Actually, they carved a statue of her recumbent body posing like this. She had her throat slit, probably because she was a singer, but the way that happened was that her martyrdom was officially supposed to be being roasted alive in a Roman bath that had the water pumped out of it. So they were going to kind of slow roast her. But when she got in, they put her in the hot bath. They presently heard beautiful singing and choral singing coming out of there. When they looked into the bathroom, they saw Cecilia surrounded by two angels. And those two angels, added to the voice of Cecilia, were singing triadic harmonies. What else? Right?
Uh-huh.
And this is a way of blessing the notion of triad among musicians.
How lovely.
But there was a counterforce, you know, which was that we only want monophonic music in church. And that counterforce still prevails in many churches.
Yeah.
They want just... But we have been more sensate in our world,
and
we have triads and major and minor and augmented and diminished, and they're all there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And however, if you had been a monk or a nun as I was, we learned Gregorian chant. We chanted three or four times a day in monotonic, I guess. Not a monotone, but a single thing of a Gregorian chant. And took a while before we did it in English. You know, we did it in Latin for a chunk of years. Okay, I'm going to mention these two sources really fast, not everything I had about them. But the first one I found in a footnote in Rohr's book, and that's that Raimondo Panica has a book called The Experience of God. You know, see, at this conference that I know I forgot earlier, I talked about the Trinity being in focusing, and this theologian who happened to be in our group came up and said, I've never heard a layperson get anywhere close to a good theology of God, but lay people shouldn't do theology. It was an interesting thing. So I'm just a little bit limping here. And so what is it that I marked? Because this book is a lovely book by Raimondo. Raimondo Panica was born of a Spanish mother and an Indian father. And he was out at the UCSB, I don't know how many years. How many of you in the audience have known of him? If not know him. Oh, I thought more of you might have. To give you how personal he is for me, I invited some people when I was just about ready to leave the convent. I was living in Goleta, and I had a whole lot of people over to our house, my apartment, to celebrate my engagement to Don George, whose wife had died some months earlier, and he said, I can't believe I didn't think of that first. He was so used to being 100 miles ahead of everybody that he knew both Don and me well. And but it was the best compliment he could have given me, and such a blessing on our relationship that he would want to have claimed that as his discovery, that we could maybe handle 43 years together, you know. Somebody said to me as I came in, where is Don? You know, and I have to, you have to know that golf is his spirituality. And it works. He is not perfect yet. So this is what Raimondo says in one little place here. He says, the experience of God cannot be monopolized by any religion. The experience of God cannot be monopolized by any religion or any system of thought, inasmuch as it is ultimate experience. So if you have a moment of the experience of God in any of the ways we've talked about so far, dancing, entering an icon, you know, inasmuch as it is ultimate experience, the experience of God is one that is not only possible, but even necessary for all human beings to arrive at the awareness of their own identity. And the other person that comes forward with the same kind of idea is David Miller. Now, I think fewer of you will have heard of David Miller. He is from University of Syracuse as a poet, literature, mythology, but he's a Jungian analyst also. And so he taught me many courses at Pacifica, and then when I was on the faculty, I had the privilege of sort of going out for drink afterwards, you know, with the whole crowd, and seeing David Miller in a crowd. And he also has this book. He says, this book is concerned for mind and heart, for understanding and life experience. both at once. So it seeks a third way, a Trinitarian way of thinking and feeling, not to mention speaking about the Trinity. Yes. Yes, it's called Three Faces of God, and this was mentioned, I think, by Father Hall, that there was, but I'm not sure if you mentioned that, Anne, that there is a Three Faces of God, or whether it was this particular picture or not.
Something close to it.
Close to it. It could be also the printing of it, and that the Three Faces in some way maybe gets at something that, you know, the old man and the young man and the bird don't quite do, you know. I like birds, that's... where is the time? What's, I have about 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Okay. So, let's see. I've done all of that. The title, A Theology of Trinity for a Time Being. I think we all have this, we're able, when I first said it, this notion of a time being is what we are. And this is valuable to know that we're not yet, if we will be, we don't know yet exactly what we'll be. One of the things I read constantly, I'm a physics fanatic, and I go to read books about, does consciousness survive death? Because personally, that's the most I can feel like I could count on. There. Okay. I want to just go back to this notion of threeness. I found one article, which I didn't bring in, on medieval women. And the title of the article is, What Wonderful Threeness You Have. And it was like talking about these medieval women, that they were very embodied. Remember, like Hildegard of Bingen, she, as well as many others, had an apothecary of medicines. And, you know, the medicines were nature, a little of this and a little of that, in order to bring you up to speed. Within Richard's book, he had one section as he's going through this notion of the experience of the Trinity, and it was the paradox of restlessness and contentment. Paradox of restlessness and contentment. And he said that we're never fully there. You know, when we're almost there, tomorrow we might be restless again. Okay? And that is healthy or good, or that's the plan. That's the process. So he mentioned something that I think is worth my while to end with, and that is the notion of negative capacity. How many of you have heard that phrase? If you were a major in English, you would have heard it, negative capacity. Okay, it's attributed to Keats, and Keats, you know, started to talk about it, the ability to hold frustration, the ability to hold the not yet, the ability to hold the burden of mystery. And he used that to criticize two of his contemporaries. I think I have it on another card. Am I going to remember it? uh, Okay, I have to let that one go.
Negative capacity, ability to hold.
To hold the burden of mystery. To hold frustration. To hold, I'm not there yet. To hold breaking down in front of a group. You know, to have the ability to hold whatever comes. Negative capacity. And so he says of two of his co-writers, and I don't want to say them backwards, but one of them had none of that. You know, he just had to spurt out goodness all the time. And the other one had such a great ability that he exceeded Milton. Now, that was a big compliment back there, because Milton, the blind poet of some centuries before, was like one of the great fathers of English poetry and literature. So Keats himself, I think, died at 26. Having shown a fair amount of capacity, I almost brought a book of Keats, but you can see I over-prepare here. So when we come back, I want to hear some of what your questions are, experiences, and I want to do the last topic in my reading. It was on page 111. It's the accessing the divine force field. Accessing the divine force field that Richard Rohr does on page 111. Okay.
Thank you.